Hello, podcast friends. Julie Bogard here from Brave Writer. First of all, thank you for listening to all the five past seasons. You helped us achieve an amazing goal, over a million downloads of our podcast, and we couldn't be more proud and more grateful. Thank you for listening, sharing, and giving us feedback. My goal in this next little while for the podcast is to answer questions that you have shared with me through Instagram, Twitter, Facebook groups, wherever you have the opportunity to reach out to us. So if you've got an idea for a podcast, feel free to send me a direct message on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. My accounts are almost always at Brave Writer, except Instagram, which is at Julie Brave Writer. So I look forward to that. And let's dive into today's topic. Today, I want to talk to you about the word love. The word love. Now, you might already be going to sleep just hearing me bring that word up. You're thinking, I've heard so much about love. Can't you just talk about tantrums or sibling rivalry or what to do when you've got six kids and six different subjects to cover? Here's what I know. To answer all those questions, all you need is love. The Beatles sang it, we believed it, but let's unpack it. Why is it that the love in your heart that is greater than an ocean for each of your children is not enough? Love is that thing we all say is essential to homeschooling and to parenting and even to personal happiness. When I think of love for myself, I want tenderness. I want understanding. In fact, I kind of want, maybe see if this is true for you, a mental telepathy on the part of the other person to know my needs now and for that other person to so read my mind, they might be like, hey, I can take care of you and meet that need because that's how well I know you and love you. You know, think about a baby who comes into the world just expressing only an abundance of need. And over time, because you faithfully meet that need, you interpret the cries, you figure out what that baby wants, you develop a trusting, loving relationship, right? You know, this kind of love, this mental telepathy love, sort of works like this by the time you become an adult. It's like when you have that itch on your back and suddenly your partner is scratching your back. Maybe you're watching TV and you lean forward and suddenly your partner, your spouse, the person that you live with, that person who's really your love relationship, they start scratching your back. And all of a sudden you can feel kind of in the upper right side that there is a special itch there. Isn't there a part of you that imagines that this person that loves you so much should be able to know where you are the itchiest? It almost feels like it's going to ruin the back scratch for you to say, hey, can you scratch the itch on the right upper part of my back as opposed to, you know, massaging the lower part? Does that ever happen to you? There's a part of you that honestly believes that that person should know where to scratch your itch, which if we're honest, is the perfect metaphor for what it feels like to be in love. It's that irrational desire to be merged, to be known, to have your needs met by the person who is the object of your fascination and admiration. I mean, it can't just be anyone. You're not just going to walk into McDonald's tomorrow and hope that the person in line behind you scratches your back and knows where you are itchy. It's that one person, the one you're closest to. It's the one that you lose your cool with because you are so intimate. You imagine that they will not make the mistake of misreading your cues that telegraph, hey, I have a need. And if you really loved me, you'd notice it and meet that need. So in fact, just this last weekend, I experienced my own desire for this psychic need meeting from the guy in my life. I had gotten pretty busy hosting guests. In fact, my sister and her family came into town for a wedding, and they were going to stay with me. At the same time, I had to make decisions for my business, some critical ones as we move into the end of the year. I was also making decisions about my house, things like buying a new washing machine or a new mattress, which drain energy from you, no matter how much you think these things should be easy. And then I also had to manage some tasks that were due right now that were outside of business and outside of household and outside of hosting guests. So you can feel sort of the plate spinning going in my own life. I was stressed. And all of the sudden, without any anticipation, I had an emotional crash. It's like I just ran into a brick wall of my needs that I had been neglecting. And I just felt flat out spent. Now, here's what's crazy. In that moment when I'm, you know, just a pool of amoeba blood and guts smeared on my own emotional wall, did I pause and admit my needs? Did I turn inward and take an inventory and say, oh, I must be spent. I must be stressed. I must have used up all my emotional resources for everyone else. I have a need. Did I then admit that need and share it vulnerably with my person, the guy in my life of 8 years who's always showing up as a great guy? Oh, no, no, no. I did not do that. And I wonder if this happens to you too. Not only did I not do it, I turned a little passive aggressive. I got a little, you know, gaslighty. Because what I was looking for wasn't for him to meet my need. I was looking for him to mind read my need. I just want you to pause and hold that thought for a minute. We all know we have needs and we deserve to have them met. But don't we sometimes want a whole higher level of need meeting? It's not enough to say, hey, I have a need, please meet it. It's, how did you not notice that I have this need? And how did you not offer to meet it? Because if you really loved me, we would be so merged, you would already know how to meet my need. So to be fair, Jim had already been doing all the things. He was helpful and available and kind and fun. But I wanted just that one titch more, that thing that would tell me, I know he loves me because he saw my need without my saying what it was and took care of me in just that way. This is the love we see in movies or we might read about in our books or we fantasize could be ours if we just, you know, swapped out our partners or lost 10 pounds, right? We think that there is this fantasy of that mutual mind-reading love where our needs will be met through an unspoken understanding at all times. What we're really talking about is a feeling of being known. Known. Like known, known, the way we actually are, accepted and gloriously helped, you know, relished and rescued all at the same time. In fact, here's the way I see this kind of need meaning love. What we're really asking for is someone to divide the burden of being me with me. You know, all the tasks, all my emotional needs will be divided in half with the person who loves me. I won't have to keep carrying the burden of myself all by myself. We want love to help us with our messy imperfections without any judgment. That feels like love. That kind of love is a lot of pressure to put on someone at all times. So in our most intimate relationships, we settle into this comfortable side of love where we trust that we are there for each other, you know, often enough. We're sensitive enough. We're caring enough. It's not 100%, but it's good enough. And then when we face that moment where the expression of, I know you better than you know yourself, love runs short. Well, then what? And that's when someone invariably suggests that term that is so polarizing, you know, self-love. The notion that you know yourself best, take better care of the you, you know and love. Now, when people talk about self-love, what they're really saying is that no one else can know you the way you know yourself. You can provide for yourself what you need. You can show yourself kindness, understanding, acceptance, and maybe even that internal mental telepathy that leads to a need being met. It's not like empty affirmations in a bathroom mirror. Self-love is, whoa, I got over my skis there. I had better pause, discover what I need, and then be brave enough to admit it and do something about it. To me, that's self-love. When people bash self-love, sometimes they picture ego stroking like, you know, well, I'll just tell myself how great I am. Other times I think maybe they're saying, well, isn't it selfish to focus on your own needs so much? Serve others and you'll be happier. Choose to act loving even if you don't feel it. And then the loving feelings will eventually follow. Have any of you heard like a version of that? I've heard that many times. And you know what? I just don't agree. I know that when I hit the brick wall of my emotional depletion, just being urged to serve others does not help me recover loving feelings for them or for me. When we are starved for love, for affection, romance, caretaking, and understanding, that hunger doesn't go away by spending more energy on others. I remember years ago hearing this teaching that love is a verb. It's an action. It's not a feeling. Yet if the only kind of love offered you is oriented towards activities that guarantee your well-being, would you feel loved? And that's really the bottom line question here. All week, I had people being kind to me, my essential needs for a house and food and meaningful work and companionship had all been met. Why was I running into a brick wall? And why was I taking it out on the person I love so much? So here's the thing. What do you feel if the loving action, the expression of love as a verb, that someone offers you is merely good for you? So let me let that sink in for a minute. We all know that kind of love that we offer that says, I'm doing this because I know it's best for you. For instance, maybe a parent says to a child, even though it hurt when I yanked your arm and pulled you from the street to save you from being run over, I did it because I love you. Even though it's true that you love the child, what the child experiences in that moment is responsible care. They know that you hurt them for their own good, or they know that you operated with a superior construct of what well-being for them means, and you enforced it. And yes, they can receive that as an act of love. But it certainly isn't the kind that fills our well of need for intimacy, for connection, for that sort of mental telepathy of spontaneous need meeting that we associate with romantic love or parent-child love. And just because, for instance, you might be married or you're living with someone and that partner finally washes the dinner dishes without being asked, and we would all agree that that is a truly loving act, is that the same love feel or experience as when that same spouse kisses you passionately under the boardwalk, or brightens like marquee lights when you walk into the room, or maybe when he brings home or she brings home your favorite chocolate bar? All of these matter, but is dishwashing love enough? Are acts of service on behalf of the other person enough to sustain the power and need meeting that love is designed to provide? Well, I just don't think so. So let's talk a little bit more about this because we're going to bring it around, I promise, to homeschool and to parenting. So hang with me. Here's what happens when we talk about love mostly as an action. We start imagining that we know what is best for the other person. We take charge of that person and call it love. Then we execute the plans for that person that are even sometimes painful or uncomfortable or not pleasurable to that person and tell them, this is what love looks and feels like from me to you. We skew the meaning of the word love and try to get everyone to agree that the hunger you have to feel loved is unnecessary for a meaningful life. That if you would simply be logical and accept my act of service or my responsible care version of love as love for you, you'll be happy enough. If you've ever been the object of good for you love, you know exactly what I mean. You start to associate pain and pressure and responsibility and sacrifice with the word love. Now, it's not to say that there aren't loving experiences that include those feelings, but that is not the set of terms we associate with the true characteristics of love or the most desirable characteristics. So then one day, some other person comes along and provides the one thing that always feels like love, utter fascination with you the way you are right now. And bam, all the songs make sense. All the rom-coms are true. All the sonnets are about you. Taylor Swift's new album, Lover, is your favorite. Because when somebody lavishes you with the kind of love that makes you feel known, you're swept off your feet. Belonging, delight in who you are, their hunger to be around you, admiration for how you live your life, all those inside jokes you create between each other, surprise messages and treats, gentle, natural affection, passion. These are the experiences, the activities of love. Responsible care is something else. It is loving and it comes from a love for someone, but it is not felt by the recipient as that feeling we often call love. If I have to persuade you that what I did for you is love, you can know right away that they did not feel it as loving. So here's another amazing thing about this felt love experience, and it is this. We don't just fall in love with another person. We fall in love with the feeling of being with the other person. It's a synergy, a chemistry that's going on. Imagine that. There's a sense of shared joy that animates conversations, outings together, even sleeping in the same bed. And you know this, whether you're sleeping together because you're a married couple, or you're sleeping with your baby, or you're taking a nap with your children in a tent out in the middle of the Anza Borrego Desert. Intimacy includes those kinds of experiences. And honestly, this is just as true for that mother-baby bonding or father-child camaraderie as it is for romantic love. So now let's circle back to the word love again and think about it in the context of our families. Love in our families is the context and the goal. Yet we sometimes forget to pay attention to what gets experienced as love. We spend so much time offering responsible care as love to our kids that we are shocked when that ease and passion dissipates from our relationships. So we'll notice, for instance, that our romantic relationship becomes a little stale and dry, even though everybody is functioning with kindness and responsibility. Or we will notice slowly over time that our kids become resentful or drag their feet or throw tantrums. We have set priorities that are about well-being rather than about the experience of being known and feeling loved. When we show admiration or delight in our kids, we are stunned to see them react to us with hugs and kisses, with big smiles, with forgiveness, maybe even with offers to help us with our tasks. In those moments when our kids feel loved, the kinks get smoothed and suddenly everyone is in the sitcom and the rom-com together. I was reading recently about an educational reformer named Paulo Freire. As I read a commentary on his work, this writer exclaimed that what made Freire revolutionary is that he was not afraid to put at the center of his pedagogy the importance of love. Love as the key to effective teaching. Love as the center of the educational experience. Now, you're homeschoolers and you're used to everybody talking about relationship and connection and creating this enchanted atmosphere. I am a person who has contributed to that narrative. Are we brave enough to recategorize all of that under the word love? What Freire means when he uses the word love is a profound appreciation for the value of the student by the teacher. The teacher doesn't come to make deposits of information into the empty minds of children. The identities, teacher and student, actually become interchangeable because in a love relationship, we are learning about each other together at all times. We are learning based on the questions we ask each other and the answers we find together, becoming fascinated and delighted by one another. Can you imagine if your child was delighting in you? Some of you have experienced this. You show up out of character. You start dancing, or you use a funny voice when you're reading aloud, or you make pancakes for breakfast when they were expecting eggs. And what your children feel, it isn't just that you're doing something nice for them. It's that they are delighted by you. And it stirs a romance in their feelings of love toward you. Here's what Freire says about teaching. And he uses the word narration, something we're so familiar with in homeschooling. Narration, he says, when the teacher is the narrator, leads the students to memorize mechanically the narrated content, you know, like a lecture. Worse yet, it turns students into containers, into receptacles to be filled by the teacher. The more completely she fills the receptacles, the better a teacher she is. The more meekly the receptacles permit themselves to be filled, the better students they are. This description that Freire just gave us of traditional teaching is what I would call the responsible care model of love. It starts with the idea that the teacher knows best and has an obligation to fill the minds of the students for their benefit, regardless of what their current need or hunger to know is. It forgets about the legitimate curiosity and hunger of the student. You know, and then we wonder why a love of learning is not the result of this kind of teaching. It's because, hello, love is absent. We are stuck in responsible care. As home educators, we brought our kids home precisely because we love them and want to love learning together. We love them so, so much. Their pudgy little hands, the mess they make on the art table, their glorious singing voices belted so loud they wake the baby. Even their attempts to read or explain an algebraic equation have the potential to awaken a surge of affection and fondness for our kids. But what happens to that felt love if we don't kindle it on the regular? Responsible care love takes over at some point. And the first thing you feel when someone sees you as a responsibility is a loss of love. Let me say that again. The first thing you feel when someone sees you as their responsibility is a loss of love. Because suddenly you have to meet their need to take care of you. You feel pressure to perform to meet their need to be responsible for you. It's axiomatic. It can't be helped. It's no one's fault. Responsible care as love takes away your own inner sense of hunger and knowing. It focuses on someone else's idea of what's best for you, which is sourced outside of you, which feels like pressure to become something that you have not yet realized you want to be. We don't fall in love with people for who they become. The falling in love, the romance, the affection, the bondedness, the intimacy comes from being more fully known as we already are. If we put the felt experience of love at the center of learning, however, how does that change how we educate? Freire would say that it gives us a chance to put inquiry and questions, what he calls problem-posing education, at the center. We start from a shared curiosity, what I call collaboration in learning, you know, partnership. As parents and educators, we have to do more than lecture our kids about what they need to learn just because we think we know best. We don't want our kids to pretend to feel loved when we do what's best for them. That puts us on this very non-intimate footing with our family. Instead, a question we want to ask ourselves is, can we inject into our children's daily experience messages and actions that let our kids and teens have the feeling of being loved? Another way to put it, a question you could ask yourself before you do anything with a child is, how will my child receive this? What will he or she feel? What an interesting question to ask. How would that change what you do tomorrow morning when you get up with your kids? Love in education means intimacy with learning, not correctness of approach. It means teacher and student become less important designations, and instead we are building a family of learners together, attentive to the voices and needs of all the members, not just your children, but parents too. It means that the outcome, hear me now, is not predetermined. It's not like you know how it's all going to turn out and you're just plotting a course to get there. There is a journey element to this, an unknowing that is guiding the education. Frankly, it means getting comfortable with the discomfort. Like you felt when you were dating and you just never knew what might happen next, but you were also excited by the not knowing yet, the anticipation that good feelings were just around the corner. Both giving love to the one you love and loving yourself, together we create the foundation for a wonderful learning environment. So let's make this practical, because I know now we've spent a lot of time on responsible care versus the emotional experience of love. You know your child, for instance, needs to learn to handwrite, right? Like, you know this, you're older, you're wiser, you've got your education, you want your child to learn to handwrite. But your child balks. So that first option is, well, I know best. I'm just going to require him to do handwriting. So that's the first option. That's the way a lot of homeschools operate. Obey me. I'm the authority. You're the child. You should do it because I said you should. And, you know, yanking a child out from, you know, traffic is that kind of move. It's, I'm responsible to provide you with care. I am demonstrating love by making sure you have what you need. You're not going to be hit by oncoming traffic. You're going to have food, and I'm going to teach you to handwrite. That is sort of the world many parents think is parental love. If you look back in your own life and imagine yourself as a small child, when your parent made you eat your peas or finish your homework or go to bed before you wanted to, did it feel like love in the moment? Or is it only that you can look back now and see that it was love? That's the question. So, your first opportunity is to say, first thing you might say is, you need to learn to handwrite, your child balks. So you either require it, or maybe you go to the next level and you think, well, you know, I've read Julie's book. I've hung out with wild and free parents. I know about this stuff. I'm just going to enchant the atmosphere. We're going to put out candles and special pens. We're going to put on beautiful music and have snacks. And then your child sits down and balks again, whines, complains. Your child is feeling manipulated, even though you had all the loving actions going and you were doing it even imagining that your child would appreciate this effort that you're making for them. So the first thing I feel when I try to do something extraordinary to show that I love my child and they don't receive it as love, I feel hurt. Even though you added enchantment and you were trying so hard, what the child is demonstrating is that you were still loving that child through responsible care to get the child to do what is on your agenda. And some of these savvy kids know it. They're on to you. They've been responsibly cared for for 8 years, 10 years, 15 years. And they're like, you can't trick me with, you know, enchantment. And that's really frustrating because you thought you were offering them, you know, perfume and flowers, like what men do sometimes instead of knowing their women intimately, you know, to use the stereotype. So let's think about this now the other way around. Let's think about how to get somewhere in this learning moment where you know your child needs to learn handwriting. And you're not going to come from responsible care or even creative responsible care. You're going to come from love as intimacy, as bonding, as process. You'll begin by admitting to yourself, I want my child to learn to handwrite, but I don't know how to make that happen. So now you think to yourself, I wonder what feels like love to this child. And you suddenly realize, actually, he loves to debate with me. And I think the first gift I could give him is listening to his reasons why he thinks handwriting is stupid. He needs to be heard completely. So I'm going to find out why he hates the idea of handwriting, and I'm just going to listen. That is the full lesson for today. The lesson for today is not handwriting. The lesson for today is getting curious about why he thinks handwriting is stupid. And I'm going to sit there patiently hearing him without reasons to overturn how stupid he thinks handwriting is. In fact, I might even take notes to value those thoughts so completely that he sees, he has visible evidence that I've taken him seriously. Once I get that he gets that I understand why he doesn't want to handwrite, I might be able to ask a question, pose a problem posing educational moment. I might say, you know what, William? Handwriting is a part of our lives. You hate it. I get it. What should we do? That's a loving moment. We are opening up the door to possibility. We are not problem solving. We are entering a process. We aren't problem solving. We are problem posing. We are engaging the critical thinking faculty of our child to address this meaningful circumstance with a partner, with an ally, with a collaborator. You might be the teacher of handwriting, but right now you are the student of your child. You are allowing your child to unveil to you that child's needs. Now, the truth is, your child may not know yet. You may not know yet. You might not get back an answer. Like, well, I hate handwriting, but here are the 6 steps that will help me get there. But at least you've now put the problem out. You've posed the problem. And you can be patient, open to new answers and opportunities. Perhaps I might start with the question, why is handwriting valuable? Maybe I've lost touch. I know for me recently, I had to fill out all of these paper invitations to my daughter-in-law's baby shower. And I got 6 invitations in and I thought, handwriting is the worst thing I've ever had to do in my life. And I realized it had been a very long time since I had used a pen for that much time all in a row. And I had this deep empathy for all children who complain about handwriting instantly. So maybe in this context, if I have a child who hates handwriting, maybe I just take up that child's tasks for a while to get a beat on it, to start to wonder, what does it feel like to work on shaping the letters and writing in this sustained way? Maybe I start using handwriting in more playful ways around the house, on post-it notes, on whiteboards, on the back of a supermarket receipt. I might even find myself chatting about how challenging handwriting is, or the fact that I'm pretty good at handwriting quickly, but it doesn't look very good when I get it done. I might even, at that point, offer to listen to him narrate where the pain points are as he's trying to write his name or copy a sentence. In other words, do some observation. Allow him to let me in a little more in his world. Maybe even ask some self-awareness provoking questions like, can you show me on your hand where the grip really hurts? Can you pick out of all these words which one you're dreading writing the most? Which of these letters is the hardest for you to look at and then remember in your brain and put it on the page? We do so little inquiry, and we don't teach our kids how to share with us what's going on inside. But we could. We could start with the problem of how does a child who hates and balks at handwriting discover the value of handwriting? You know, and then the other alternative might be to simply focus on something else for a while until he matures. I'm going to value what he brings to the table. You know, his recklessness about his education. He doesn't yet see the long-term picture. How could he? He's only 8. He's only 10. His resistance. He doesn't yet have the patience to push himself to work on something difficult. How can I lower the bar to experience success? I can appreciate his impatience. Perhaps he has too much to say and he's still too slow at conveying it on his own time with his own hand. So I still jot down his thoughts for him a little longer to capture that voice on his behalf. And maybe I just focus on his joy in learning other things because since I love him, I know him and I do know what he loves. And we can just fill the love bucket for now. Those are all ways that we get at the love dynamic in education as opposed to responsible care dressed up with donuts or candles. Hear what I'm saying? Something like that. Now, Jeannie Faulkner, who is the director of our Homeschool Alliance, said to me the other day that homeschooling is not a problem to solve. It is a process that becomes a way of life. And too often we enter into these problems with the notion that if we just get a good trick going, we'll solve the problem of our child so that we can be responsible caregivers. Can you see how far away that is from the experience of love? This kind of homeschooling that I'm advocating, where we put love at the center, is not something to be done to children. It is a way of life. It is capital T, the capital W way. In fact, years and years ago, someone I really looked up to used to say, the way in is the way on. The way in is the way on. The way in to this discussion about how your child can be guided into learning is the way on. When we ask those curious questions, when we show compassion and curiosity, when we're interested in what our child is bringing to the table right now, not what we hope they'll do on our behalf, that is actually the critical thinking piece. It is the way they develop the self-awareness to become effective learners. It's the way they show up for themselves eventually with self-love, because they are learning the tools to help themselves navigate the challenges of being human by the modeling that you are giving them, by the genuine care and engagement that you offer them as their loving parent. It's a practice, almost like yoga or prayer or exercise, that grows all of you over time. Not just you, not just your kids. You are actually creating a family culture of learning. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love isn't about getting through or getting done. And if there's been a lot of responsible care, love in your family, it may take a little time to rekindle the quote, in love feelings, a little detox from too much love as a responsible action, until you rediscover just how adorable and wonderful and interesting and capable and smart your kids already are. It's okay. It takes time. And sometimes it takes more time with one child than another, and that's okay too. Start small. Be curious. You can start with yourself. Be kind to yourself first. You are capable and smart and interesting and amazing. Let that love grow in you through acceptance and forgiveness and gradual faith. That's what we look for in our romantic partners. That's what children look for in their parents, no matter how old those children are. I dare say some of you are still looking for it in your parents right now, and you're well over 30. See where your family goes when the pedagogy for your homeschool and family culture is felt love. Thanks for joining me today. This podcast is available, obviously, on whatever player you're using, Stitcher, iTunes, and I would so appreciate a review if you haven't given one before. Please feel free to share it with friends, and we will offer transcripts eventually. We are updating all our previous podcasts, so feel free to share this with your hard of hearing friends as well. If you'd like to know more about Brave Writer, visit us at bravewriter.com. And of course, I am available even by personal contact through Instagram. My account is at Julie Brave Writer. Thanks for joining me in this podcast, A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. The way in is the way on. Love and learning go hand in hand. I wish you both. Have a great day.